From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Summertime, we hope you'll hike and surf and camp and play and read. But what? 50 Shades of Grey is burning up the ebook bestseller list. But there's more to life than that. George Orwell's back. Toni Morrison, Richard Ford, great tales, journeys, lives. This hour, On Point Best Summer Reads 2012. You can join the conversation. What are you packing to the beach, to the backyard? Gone Girl, Snow Child, Wild, Ready, Player One? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We've got great readers with us today, three of them with their recommendations. From Houston, Texas, Maggie Galehouse joins us, book critic for the Houston Chronicle. She writes at the blog called Bookish. Maggie, welcome back. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me back, Tom.
From Culver City, California, we're joined by David Yulin, book critic for the Los Angeles Times, author himself of the forthcoming book Labyrinth. David, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
And from Petoskey, Michigan, way up on the mitten, is Jessalyn Norcross. She owns, co-owns, McLean and Eakin Booksellers, high up on Lake Michigan, great summer country, with her husband, Matt. Jessalyn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So first, just cards on the table about summer reading. I don't know. Maggie, do you remember back to a particular summer or book or moment of youth where it all came together and you said, I love reading in the summer and want to be a book critic?
I do, but it's embarrassing.
What was it?
It was Little Women, which I can't even read anymore. It's kind of... but for some reason, it spoke to me. It was all girls. One was a tomboy. Yes. One was gentle. One was angelic, you know. And it, I read it over and over and over again.
But I can just picture it. Well, we leave many behind. We pick up new ones. That's the whole point. David, what about you? Was there a summer moment that just caught you in the hammock in a book and you were swept off?
It would be summer after fifth grade when I discovered Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut, which I don't think I understood at the time, but it blew the top of my head off, and I've never quite gotten it back on.
And Jessalyn, what about you? I don't know how long you've been up in a cool summer in northern Michigan, but do you have an association with a particular book or summer when reading was the thing that sent you?
Well, it's not a particular book, but as soon as summer hit, that was my time. I didn't have to read anything else that anybody else wanted me to read, and I thought my mom was a sucker when she would send me outside and not realize I had a book stashed in the back of my pants.
Oh, boy. She walks funny, but she reads real well, that girl. Start us right out, Maggie. You've got a book called Wild. I've heard a little bit about it. It's a journey. Tell us.
Yeah, this book, I think people will be hearing a lot about it because Oprah, her book club is back, Oprah's Book Club 2.0.
Oprah's gone, but the book club never goes.
The book club goes on, and it's now sort of incorporating different things for e-readers. And Wild is her first pick, so I think if you haven't seen it, people might know this book. It's got a big hiking boot with red shoelaces on it on the cover, so you may have seen it in bookstores or seen it around.
Cheryl Strayed,
exactly, okay. Yes. And she is she's a writer, and she's done online columns, and it's the story. It's a memoir about her when she was 26. She hiked a big chunk of the Pacific Crest Trail, which starts in Mexico and goes I think all the way up to Canada. But she kind of hiked from the Mojave Desert up to Washington State, and I think the book is great. It's it's a book about hiking, and it's a book about being outside. But she's a very kind of honest and flawed person. Her marriage was falling apart. Her family had sort of disbanded, and she decided to do this crazy hike. She really hadn't hiked that much before, incredibly. And she walked over about 100 days, nearly 1,100 miles alone, over terrain that was difficult, ice and all sorts of things. And I think why it's great is that, she's not a perfect person. She sort of owns her her screw-ups and her oddities, mm-hmm. and sort of thought she'd be hiking and having a wonderful time thinking about her life, when really a lot of it was just so difficult physically that she was just putting one foot in front of another and kind of had her head was blank. Mm-hmm. The end result was kind of this healing and understanding about who she was, but it's almost like she had to break herself down and rebuild herself.
Not a road trip. But an off-road trip here. Maybe.
It's an off-road trip, and there are times she comes down the mountain and gets drunk and meets people, has a little fling.
Want to read a little bit for us? You got our interest. Have you got a piece?
Yeah, sure, sure. This is a little passage about her name. She was in the process of splitting up with her husband, and she chose a new name for herself, and the name is Strayed. It's the one that's on the book. And here's her thinking about her new name that she's picked. And she says this, she writes this, "I had diverged, digressed, wandered, and become wild. I didn't embrace the word as my new name because it defined negative aspects of my circumstances or life, but because even in my darkest days, those very days in which I was naming myself, I saw the power of the darkness, saw that, in fact, I had strayed, and that I was astray, and that from the wild places my straying had brought me, I knew things I couldn't have known before. Cheryl Strayed, I wrote repeatedly down a whole page of my journal, like a girl with a crush on a boy she hoped to marry."
Oh, that's
kind of great.
Cheryl Strayed, the woman who walked 1,100 miles and made her name a verb. That's great. A thumbs up there for Wild by Cheryl Strayed. David, you've got The 20-Year Death at the top of your list, or near the top. Tell us about that one, Ariel Winter's book.
Right. It's a first novel. It's a crime novel. It's from Hard Case Crime, which is an imprint I really like. They do, I guess we'd call them neo-noirs. They do books. They create sort of those classic, like, 50s pulp covers. But this is a really ambitious project. It's a crime novel in the form of three crime novels that take place over 20 years, one in 1931, one in 1941, one in 1951. And they're written in the style of three classic crime novelists. So the first book, or the first part of the novel, is written in the style of Georges Simenon, the Belgian crime novel, the creator of Inspector Maigret. The second one is a California noir in the style of Raymond Chandler. Speaks to my heart as an Angeleno. And the third one is in the style of Jim Thompson. The one that takes place in the 1950s is in the style of Jim Thompson.
This is sort of 1931, 41, 51, but all within one great book.
All within one, you know, the three connect into one larger whole. And it interests me for a couple reasons. One, I'm always interested in books that blur the lines a little bit. And so this is a kind of a crime novel that steps outside itself, that reaches for something bigger, I think. I love the idea of the literary homage. And as a debut novel, I mean, you know, it's if you're going to start, you might as well start with a bang. So this one is one that I'm particularly looking forward to this summer. It's a genre I like quite a bit.
Can you give us a little sound of it? Have you got a piece?
Yeah, in the interest of not giving away too much of the book, I decided that I would simply pick the opening of the first sequence, which is a very Simenon-esque kind of moody atmospheric thing. So,
from The 20-Year Death by Ariel Winter. Let's hear it.
"The rain started with no warning. It had been dark for an hour by then, and the night had masked the accumulation of clouds. But once it began, the raindrops fell with such violence that everyone in Ver-Argent felt oppressed. After 40 minutes of constant drumming, it was near 8 o'clock, Tuesday, April 4th, 1931, the rain eased some, settling into the steady spring rainfall that would continue throughout the night." Just a little scene setter.
Like it. Genre work, but it's reaching out for something without giving it away, the story away. What's it reaching out for?
Well, the reach out is less about the story per se than about this kind of the placing of the story, the idea of these three things, the idea that it sort of spans continents and spans 20 years. Most crime novels are fairly concise, both in terms of setting and in terms of chronology. And so the idea that it's a book that stretches, across a wide geographic span and also a wide temporal span, while also paying deliberate homage to these sort of masters of the genre, if you will, is something that really appeals to me, that kind of ambition. It's a big book. It's about 600 pages long.
Jesslyn Norcross, way up in Michigan, you've got The Cove by Ron Rash at the top of your list. Now, we've heard from him before, New York Times bestseller with Serena, Appalachian setting. What is it, The Cove?
Well, this is an incredible historical novel. Everything that Ron Rash does is incredible. I always think that every time I pick up one of his new books, I'm bound to be disappointed because there's no way it could be as good as the last. And every single time I am put back into this Appalachian world and continue to be impressed by his writing, his characters, and just the way that he captures the moment. And the setting is always so important in his books. None of his books could be set anywhere else. It's almost as if the backdrop is a character.
And a rugged kind of part of Appalachia there, North Carolina, dark sort of stretch where a stranger, a mute stranger, shows up with a silver flute. Where does it take us?
Yes, it's a very dark tale, and which is indicated by the title, which, living near water, I had no idea that a cove could be this dark, cavernous ravine, and it's a place where no light can shine, and it's within these mountain passes, and it just captures you in a way that's very hard to describe, and only somebody like Ron Rash could do.
Doomed love affair. You've got a nation at war, and a stranger who comes to town, almost stung to death by yellow jackets, way back in that deep hollow, that ravine, that cove, and secrets come out.
Yes, you open, the book opens with a secret. It's a man who stumbles across land that is told to be forsaken by the local people. And you're not entirely sure why. You know that they mark it with talismans. They tell people to stay away. And this man who wanders into this land finds a skull in the well. And then you flash backward and you spend the rest of the story worried about whose skull that might be.
A skull in the well? In the Cove by Ron Rash. Jocelyn Norcross, stand by there in Michigan if you would. David Yulin in California. Maggie Gelhaus down in Houston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking about great summer reads for 2012. Summer books for your lazy days in the hammock, on the porch, at the beach, if you can find them. David Yulin is with us from the Los Angeles Times book critic there. Maggie Gelhaus from the Houston Chronicle. Jocelyn Norcross, she and her husband are co-owners of McLean and Eakin Booksellers way up in northern Michigan. She joins us from Petoskey, Michigan there. Suggestions online here. Nutra says, I'm 75% through Wild. Cheryl Stray, what is it? Strayed Book of Journey says, cannot put it down. Paul says he's into Vladimir's Mustache by Stephen Eric Clark. Amazing set of 9 short stories, all focus on Russian history from Peter the Great to Stalin to modern bride hunting scams. John likes Shalom Auslander's Hope, a Tragedy. Gerald goes for Charles Strauss's Laundry series. Computers can do magic and so are more dangerous than you can imagine. Toni Morrison's out with a new book this summer, a new novel called Home, a young American, African-American, Frank Money, returning to the U.S. after the Korean War, has trouble with local authorities, first put in jail, then a mental ward. Toni Morrison joined us a month or so ago. She read an excerpt of Home for us, her latest, just out this summer, in which Frank Money, back from the Korean War, experiences here, and Toni Morrison's reading, a little episode of PTSD.
It happened the first time. When he boarded a bus near Fort Lawton, discharged, papers intact, he was quiet, just sitting next to a brightly dressed woman. Her flowered skirt was a world's worth of color, her blouse a loud red. Frank watched the flowers at the hem of her skirt blackening and her red blouse draining of color until it was white as milk. Then everybody, everything, outside the window, trees, sky, a boy on a scooter, grass, hedges, all color disappeared, and the world became a black and white movie screen.
Toni Morrison with us here at On Point just last month, reading from her latest, Home, which is out maybe for your summer reading. You can join us with what you're looking for, what you found, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Maggie Gelhaus in Houston, I saw the ebook bestseller list this morning. In the top 4 positions are all 50 Shades of Grey or one of the others in that series or a companion. It's just unbelievable. Now, I haven't dipped in there. I know it's sex, it's hot, it's domination stuff. You've got a little reading for that just for people who don't know about it. And this is a little on the risque side, but it's not into the whoop-de-doo side. Give us a sense for people who haven't been there.
I don't think there's any bad
words. Okay.
You want me to just jump in?
So people, I want to talk about it, but for people who have no idea or aren't telling, let's hear a little.
Okay, here is an excerpt. This is actually from sort of late in the book, and I had to look around to find one that gave you flavor but was readable on the air. Mm. Anyway, so here it is. Slowly, he slides the mask on, pulling the elastic over the back of my head, and I'm blind. The elastic on the mask holds the earbuds in place. I can still hear him, though the sound is muffled as he rises from the bed. I'm deafened by my own breathing. It's shallow and erratic, reflecting my excitement. Christian takes my left arm, stretches it gently to the left-hand corner, and attaches the leather cuff around my wrist.
And off we go, 50 Shades of Grey. I'm reading here, this is from the Washington Post. They say, the quasi-pornographic bestseller that is doing for sadomasochism and leather crops what Harry Potter did for British boarding schools and broomsticks, publishing sensation, a supernova in the zeitgeist, cultural lightning rod. It's also, says the Washington Post, atrociously written, proof positive that execrable prose is no bar to dominating, the bestsellers list. David, what do you make of the, like, super sales here?
Well, I should be in full disclosure, I haven't read it, nor do I have any intention of reading it. I mean, I don't know what to make of it exactly, but I often don't know what to make of what becomes sort of best-selling phenomena. I suppose it's good that books that, you know, started out as self-published can be picked up by majors and distributed. I do like the general idea in terms of e-book publishing and self-publishing that the tools of production have been put in the hands of the workers, but I'm extremely skeptical about this particular product. My general sense is if you want to read about domination and read pornography, you should probably just read pornography.
Jesslyn, is it flying off the shelves in your bookstore there in Michigan, or is it everybody getting it on their Kindle?
Well, we sell it in the ebook version on our website, and we are selling tons of it off of the shelf. We've started saying that we all turn 50 shades of red when people come in and ask for it. I will confess that I tried to read it, yeah. And even though I was alone, I could only get through 4 pages before I had to close the book and felt very ashamed and was worried my mother was going to know what I was reading.
Okay, so give us something else you are reading and enjoying, Jesslyn. Wonder, a book by R.J. Palacio, I guess?
Yes, this is a book that was actually introduced to me by our children's buyer, and everyone on my staff who's read it has insisted that every teacher, every parent, and every child should read this book. And so in preparation for today, I started listening to it last night. Mm. And it is indeed very moving. Your heart aches for this child who
has... You got a fifth grader with... What's the situation?
He has some very serious facial deformities and some other health problems that have required surgery over the past, 10 years, 12 years of his life, at least 2 a year. He's had 27 surgeries, and that is one of the reasons that he was never enrolled in a traditional school setting. And now he's going into fifth grade, and his parents have decided that maybe this would be a good time for him to start. It'll be a middle school situation, so everyone will be new, and it might take some of the pressure off of him.
One community is struggling there with empathy and compassion and acceptance. That's
yes.
Wonder by R.J. Palacio, kind of a children's chapter book. Maggie, you've got one on Walter Cronkite, no less, who we used to call the most trusted man in America, Douglas
That's
Brinkley,
right.
With a biography. Is there something, anything, a lot we didn't know about Walter Cronkite?
Well, it's fun to be going from 50 Shades of Grey to Walter Cronkite. I just have to say that.
Yeah, right. Would make that mustache bristle, maybe.
That's right. Well, actually, maybe not. I mean, I think what's fun about this book is if you're kind of a media junkie, it's the story of Walter Cronkite, who was really, on the ground he wrote for The Wires and, he covered the Second World War, but he was at the very beginning of television. And so when you read about his life, it's about newspapers and then the move, to radio and then TV. And if you care about media and you think about these things, you realize that this conversation about, which form of media is going to take over the other and render, something else obsolete has just been going
on and on
for a long time.
Yeah.
And here we are in a radio show,
right,
talking
right.
about it.
Nevertheless. Yeah.
But Cronkite was fun. I mean, Cronkite, he liked to party. He was a great storyteller. Obviously, he had sharp elbows because he sort of, made his way, to the
tough
top
business.
Of the top of the business. Mm-hmm. And he did it with sort of kindness, but sort of firmness. And he was really, you know, a Midwesterner. He was from Missouri. And he wasn't, you know, the most handsome man. He was maybe an unlikely person to become what he did. And I think that's, you know, I think that's why he's so interesting. And, you know, so that's why I liked it. You know, he's one of the things Brinkley says in the book is that he was like, you know, in the newsroom, he was sort of like Duke Ellington. You know, he was the head of an orchestra. He kind of kept the show together.
That's great.
And I don't think we think about that. We think about him in our living rooms, this kindly
solo
man.
Guy,
but
yeah.
Yeah. But he wasn't, you know, and there's like big touchstones in history, like when he announced, you know, John F. Kennedy's death. I mean, that's a moment in time that he's part of, you know. And so it's
first
really
steps on the moon for a whole generation of Americans. A really deep history there. I met him late in his life, a charming man at that point. But as you say, long up from Missouri and Texas and the Depression, World War II, a lot to that life. Cronkite there by Douglas Brinkley. We've got a lot to look at, and we've got listeners with suggestions as well. Let's get a call from Nantucket, no less. Penny, on the island. What do you know, Penny?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to recommend a book written by a Nantucket author.
Okay.
First novel by Catherine Kay called The Gilder, and just a terrific story of a young American woman who goes to Florence to learn the art of gilding. And the decisions she makes there, some mistakes, and how they impact the rest of her life.
Gilding as in applying gold to things? What does that mean?
Yes. Gilding as in applying gold leaf. Yeah. So wonderful descriptions of Florence and food and places for people who have visited Italy. It really just brings that very much to life. But also just a great story of relationships and growing up and living with the consequences of decisions you've made.
You're on Nantucket. Does it qualify as a beach read?
Well, it's not a fluffy beach read, but I think it draws you in. So for me, that's what I want in a beach read, something that's going to really hold my interest.
Sounds fantastic, and I appreciate your call, Penny. The Gilder by Catherine Kay. Thank you so much for that. Matt in Lynn, Massachusetts. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Very well. What are you reading?
I just read The Sun Also Rises by Ernest Hemingway, and it was just perfect for where I was. I was traveling at the time, and I just loved the setting and just the seedy bars in Paris and then the bullfighting in Spain, and it just really just captured me. I loved it.
Did you get lost in that whole world? Was that what you wanted in a summer read, Matt?
Yeah, exactly. I just finished college, and I just wanted something to just kind of relax me, and it was perfect.
Absolutely. The Sun Also Rises by Hemingway. We've got George Orwell diaries out this summer. We'll look at those. Matt, I appreciate your call. Let me get one more. Angelica in Montreal in Canada. Angelica, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to recommend a wonderful book written by a Connecticut history professor who's also a military historian, Roger Norman Buckley. And the book is called Congo Jack. It deals with the late 18th century, a time when slaves were being brought to the Caribbean to fight the Napoleonic Wars, the British against the French. And it's about how the slaves, some of them, at least the better-bodied ones, were chosen to fight in the West India regiments, and how the ideals of the French Revolution infiltrated into the slave encampments and into the barracks. And it deals with a real revolutionary fervor and also an uprising that did take place in Dominica. And I won't give it away because it's also like a very suspenseful book as well as historically based. And Congo Jack is part of a trilogy that Mr. Buckley wrote. It's called Three Chos Rebellion. And the first one is Congo Jack. The second is I, Hanuman, which deals with the mutiny, the sepoy mutiny in India, and or rebellion, as it's sometimes referred to, and the death and life of an Irish soldier. But I would really recommend Congo Jack for people who are interested in slave history, military history, and the events taking place in San Domingo and Dominica and the formation of Haiti. It's just so thrilling. I actually wrote a play on it last summer based on the story. So I
really got you going.
That Congo Jack is so exciting.
We got it, Angelica. Congo Jack, I Hanuman, the monkey-faced god, and all the rest there from Roger Dorman Buckley. Thanks very much for the recommendation. We're looking at great summer reads for 2012. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. David, speaking of greats, you got George Orwell out with some diaries this year. What's in them? What's going on? Is this something that's been published before or just brought to the fore, David?
It hasn't been published in the United States before, although there is a website called, I think it's orwelldiaries.org, I think, or .net. Anyway, mm-hmm. You can find it on, you can Google it, which for the last several years has been reproducing Orwell's diary entries 70 years to the day after they first ran as sort of a sequence of blog posts, which has been a kind of an interesting project. They're not related, this publication and that, except in
what period, in what setting is Orwell in here? Is he out in the world?
Is this late
Burmese
30s.
Days? Or?
It's all throughout that period. This is late 30s through the end. And he died in 1950. Mm-hmm. And so they're interesting as a kind of commentary on his work and what he's going through. But they're also interesting in terms of just sort of particularly the stuff in Second World War is fascinating because he's talking about his experience of the war. There's a lot of stuff about what he's hearing in the media, what he's hearing on the BBC, and comparing it, trying to track the war through from the home front.
Does his voice, his perspective line up in his diaries with what we know of Orwell from his very famous books and reports?
It does. I mean, I think, the thing that's interesting about these diaries is, I mean, they're not for the uninitiated, I would say. Mm-hmm. Some of them are fairly mundane. Some of them, he talks about the weather. He talks about the kind of things, where he went to dinner, those sorts of things.
Not Animal Farm, not 1984 always.
Mm-hmm. No, but some of them are essayistic and speak to the books. He talks about what he's working on. He sort of, they're little set pieces. And what kind of comes through, which for me is what always comes through with Orwell, I really think of Orwell as kind of, the conscience of the 20th century, mm-hmm. and maybe a kind of literary conscience in a certain way, is that sort of that clarity, that moral vision, that kind of that sense of sort of seeing what's in front of you and writing about it. And there is slightly more personal. I mean, even his personal essays, as such as they are, his lyrical essays in general are kind of shape. There's a little bit of authorial distance. Here you kind of see Orwell wrestling a little bit with the stuff of life. With, he talks about his garden, he talks about his health, he talks about his relationships, those kind of things. And so it's a little bit of a personal filter on someone who, sort of, he used his personal experience in his work, but he used it in a particular way. So you get a little bit behind the veil here.
Diaries brought back from George Orwell. Dave in Spokane, Washington. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think I would go back to some of the adventure narratives that I really love, including one of my favorites is Touching the Void, which I just think is a great window into a person and a situation that's just extremely difficult. And
who's the author, Dave? Do you remember Touching the Void? Who wrote it?
Yeah, it's Joe Simpson, actually. Mm-hmm. He's a British guy who got stuck with a broken leg on a peak in South America about 15 years ago now, I think. It's an amazing story. All the best adventure narratives are about the sport and the adventure, but they're about the people, and Touching the Void's really, it's an amazing story about a person in a really difficult situation and a great guy. In fact, I like the suggestion of Wild. I think I'm going to have to go and look that one up now.
Great. David, I appreciate your call from Spokane, Washington to a peak in South America in Touching the Void. We'll come back and look at much more. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about great summer reads for 2012, summer books for your lazy day or days in the hammock, at the beach, on the porch. David Ulin is with us, book critic for the Los Angeles Times, Maggie Galehouse from the Houston Chronicle, Jessalyn Norcross from way up in northern Michigan, Petoskey, Michigan, co-owner of McLean and Aiken booksellers there. Their lists are up at our website, onpointradio.org. Lots of people shipping in what they're looking forward to or what they've loved. Christopher Buckley's They Eat Puppies, Don't They, says AJ. Can't wait. Political satire at its best. Green John Like Zorro by Isabel Allende. She's been our guest, and yeah, she does a great job. Carrie says The Loved One by Evelyn Waugh about the funeral business in Los Angeles. Okay, there's a summer read in your backyard, David. She also likes For the Summer, The Metamorphosis by Franz Kafka. Wow, okay, she'll go there. And Ian says Ready Player One. I think that's on somebody. I mean, is that on your list, David? I read about that somewhere. Who's
no,
got
it's not on my list.
Ready Player One? I don't know. Does anybody know it? Maggie? Jesselyn?
Yes, that's on my list. This is Jesselyn.
Yeah, what is it?
Ready Player One is a fantastic book that we discovered last year by a very energetic guy named Ernest Klein, and who drove a DeLorean across the country for his author tour.
Okay. And if Back that to gives the future.
You, yes, if that gives you a little insight. The book is...
Science fiction, right?
Well, it is definitely science fiction, and it is all focused around 80s culture and pop culture. So anyone who grew up in the 80s or appreciates the 80s or doesn't appreciate the 80s will definitely get a kick out of the book.
But this is like a video game world that that gets out of hand or something.
Yes. In the future, everyone lives online. They're going to school online. They are playing video games online, and that is where the real world seems to be happening, whereas in the physical world, things are disintegrating badly. And
we can relate to this.
Yeah. Well, it definitely does have a great message about, you know, you can't live your life online, and that, you know, sometimes physical things are better than a digital version. And we think it's a great pick for high school students as well. We even have a high school here that's going to read it as a summer read.
Ready Player One by Ernest Klein. Maggie Gelhaus, you've got one by Mark Strand called Almost Invisible. This takes us into different territory. Introduce us.
Mark Strand is a poet. He's in his late 70s now. Why I like this book is it's a small sort of compressed book. It's when you open it up, the pages, there's little pieces. They're sort of prose poems, and they're they look like big paragraphs. You know, it's not so for people who are afraid of poetry, and I know they're out there. You know, this is something that, you know, at least formally on the page is sort of easy to digest. Why I like this is like the kind of a book that flies under the radar forever. And these are just tiny little paragraphs. Because he's a poet, they're compressed, they're thick. They're about, you know, they're almost like fables or riddles about getting older, you know, what happens when we die. It's often nighttime or dusk. He's often at the beach. You know, it's contemplative. And and they're small. And I think in the summer, it's nice to read something small but thoughtful. You know, you feel like you've done something without, you know, having a 600-page book kind of on your lap. And I really like this book.
Do you have a little bit from it there in front of you?
I do. I have a kind of spooky little paragraph here that I can read. This piece is called Harmony in the Boudoir. Here it is. After years of marriage, he stands at the foot of the bed and tells his wife that she will never know him, that for everything he says, there is more that he does not say, that behind each word he utters, there is another word, and hundreds more behind that one. All those unsaid words, he says, contain his true self, which has been betrayed by the superficial self before her. So you see, he says, kicking off his slippers, I am more than what I have led you to believe I am. Oh, you silly man, says his wife. Of course you are. I find that just thinking of you having so many selves receding into nothingness is very exciting. That you barely exist as you are couldn't please me more.
That's
it's
just
a very
great.
Strange little paragraph. Yes. You don't quite know how to take it.
But you can think about it all the rest of the afternoon while you're
exactly.
gardening.
Yes, and look at your spouse with, you know, fear or something.
Right, New Eyes, Almost Invisible by Mark Strand, fable and domestic satire, meditation, joke, fantasy, all in one there. We've got a lot more to learn. Howie in Washington, Vermont. Howie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to suggest a book that I've read and reread many times now.
Great.
First read it in my forestry class at high school.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold. It's a kind of timeless commentary on natural world and the nature of life and how they relate to each other.
And
it's written in very elegant prose and a very, very excellent book.
Takes you into a deeper understanding of the wild and wonderful world around us.
Yeah, and how we should relate to it, but how we do as well.
Great. Aldo Leopold, the Sand County Almanac. Thank you, Howie. Pilar in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Pilar, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I wanted to recommend a series of books that I read a couple of years ago. It's called The Ringing Cedars, and they're out of Russia. They were published in 1995, self-published initially, and they become a publishing phenomenon. They were translated into English in 2005. It's a series of 9 books. A friend of mine recommended the first one, which is called Anastasia, or Anastasia. Mm-hmm. But it has nothing to do with the Russian royal family that most people are associate with mm-hmm. Russia. And I read all 9 books while I was pregnant with my first child, first and only child. And I read one, and I couldn't wait to read all 9, and I actually read them in 10 weeks.
This is The Ringing Cedars, C-E-D-A-R-S, as in the tree, I guess. Is it a family saga, or what have you got there?
It is a true story. It's written by Vladimir Megre, M-E-G-R-E, and who never set out to write any books. But essentially, what the beginning of the story, he is an entrepreneur, a Russian entrepreneur, going up to the Siberian taiga on the River Ob, which is one of the few rivers that flows north. On his way, he meets these two very unusual gentlemen, a grandfather and a great-grandfather. And as he's getting ready to leave port, he took 4 ships there, and they asked him if he would please assist them in cutting down a ringing cedar that had started to reverberate, and it was over 500 years old, and he'd never heard of it. And they said, please, we need your help. Can you come help us cut this tree down? And you can take the wood, and please cut it up and give it to people because it's very healing. But they said, please don't charge any money for it. Well, you can imagine, as a businessman, he thought they were crazy. And he said, I can't help you. This is going to take me off my timeline, and there's no money in it for us, and I'm so sorry. Well, a year passed, and he went home, and couldn't get it out of his mind what they were talking about. And he started to research online about cedar trees and the healing properties of cedar trees and the biblical references and all the things that they'd spoken about. And it was true. What he could find out was true. So when he returned a year later, he tried to find them and ended up finding their great-granddaughter, Anastasia. She took him into the forest and taught him these ancient ways and said, you're going to write these books about this.
Oh, Pilar, you've got us way out on our way to the Russian taiga and ringing cedars. You're a good storyteller, too. I'm just about in a trance listening here. But 9 books, I don't think we'll get through all. But I love that introduction to it, The Ringing Cedars. Thank you for it, Pilar. Thank you very much. David, give us another off your list. You've got Journalism by Joe Sacco. Now, this is a long way. This is not fiction. This is something else again. Tell us.
Yeah, this is as the title suggests, this is journalism, but it's a particular kind of journalism. Sacco is a comics artist, and he
as in cartoon, kind of.
In mm-hmm. comic strip mm-hmm. or comic. Yep. He's done mostly long-form book length. This is the first collection of his shorter work, which has appeared in places like the Boston Globe, New York Times Magazine, Harper's. Mm-hmm. What he does is, you know, he goes to, I hesitate to say hotspots. He really focuses on the disenfranchised. He goes to refugee camps. He's written a lot from the occupied territories, from Bosnia, from Chechnya, from rural India, and these are stories where he, you know, his project is really to sort of give voice to the voiceless. He's been accused of being subjective or having a particular slant, which I think he does, but I also think that that's a bit reductive. And in this book, he actually addresses that by saying that comics are by their nature subjective. You know, if you shoot a photograph, a news photograph of something, the photograph is there. You take the shot, and what's there is there. A comics artist is always choosing what goes into the frame. So he writes this really interesting introduction to this book where he sort of lays out what his journalistic aesthetic is, if we can call it that,
mm-hmm.
And talks about kind of what that quality of subjectivity has given him, a kind of empathy, a sense of being on his toes all the time, and to be frank, an awareness that all journalism is in its way subjective. He's a great, he quotes Murrow, Edward R. Murrow, mm-hmm. Cronkite's mentor, I guess, saying that, you know, it's not a matter of not having biases or prejudices, but it's a matter of, I'm paraphrasing badly, but a matter of recognizing those prejudices and biases and trying not to let them get in the way. But it's a fascinating book. He goes all over the world
Gaza and Abu Ghraib stories, the Hague and Gaza, Bosnian warlords.
He's embedded. There's one of the best stories in the book is a story of him being embedded with the Marines in Iraq, where, you know, at the end of the story, he talks about a patrol that he goes on. And then on the next day, the day that he didn't go, that same patrol is ambushed and several of the people he was with are killed or wounded. And there really is a sense of kind of how close to the line he is. And in some way, the kind of visceral immediacy of his images makes us feel present in those scenes as well. He's just a phenomenal artist in the first place. I mean, kind of in terms of how he puts his pages together and how he tells his stories, but also I think quite a rigorous journalist and doing something morally significant in terms of who he is empowering and who he's giving voice to in his work.
Do you have a little reading for us there, David?
Yeah, and it's hard to excerpt from a graphic novel, as you can imagine, for a radio show. So I just picked a small quote from the introduction that sort of sets up how he sees his project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've picked the stories I want to tell. And by those selections, my own sympathies should be clear. I chiefly concern myself with those who seldom get a hearing, and I don't feel it is incumbent on me to balance their voices with the well-crafted apologetics of the powerful. The powerful are generally excellently served by the mainstream media or propaganda organs. The powerful should be quoted, yes, but to measure their pronouncements against the truth, not to obscure it. If I believe power brings out the worst in people, I've observed that those on the short end of the stick don't always acquit themselves well either, and I've endeavored to report that. I think the great British journalist Robert Fisk gets the equation about right. Quote, I always say that reporters should be neutral and unbiased on the side of those who suffer.
David Ulan, they're reading from Joe Sacco's Journalism. We're looking at great summer reads for this. It's the summer of 2012. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Cape Cod, summertime territory. And Nancy. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What are you reading? What do you like?
I just finished a book called Brand New Human Being, and the author is Emily Jean Miller.
Okay.
And it's about a family whose patriarch died, and the family has to finally stand on their own and find themselves. And it's about a husband and a wife and a child and a widow. It takes place in Montana, and its descriptions are lovely. And the characters, some you'd like to wring their neck, but yeah. They're not forgettable, you know. They're very interesting.
Human Being by Emily Jean Miller. Nancy, our time is short, but I appreciate the recommendation there. Hey, Maggie, while we're on that Montana territory, what about Richard Ford's Canada? It's getting lots of critical attention. I don't know if you've dipped into it yet, but I think it starts out up in Montana territory.
Yes, doesn't it go to Canada, to be honest
north,
with you?
Yeah.
Yes. I have not read this book. I can't say anything. You know, honestly, I don't know about it. I know that, you know, people are reading it, and I know that one of my reviewers reviewed it favorably, but I haven't read it.
David, Jesslyn, have you dipped in yet to Canada?
I've read it, and I think it does begin in Montana, and it's in two parts. It begins in Montana, and it ends in Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, Ford's Montana stuff is great. I think that, you know, the first half of this book is really quite lovely. I think it sort of unravels a bit in the second half, although I think on the whole it's quite a good book. The main character is a 15 or 16-year-old boy. It takes place in 1960, starts as we said, starting in Montana, mm-hmm. which is a return to the territory of Wildlife and Rock Springs, which are two of my favorite of Ford's mm-hmm. books. And I think he really gets inside, understands the head of the adolescent in general, and really the adolescent boy, and the kind of floating nature of that life, the uncertainty of everything, the kind of the self-consciousness and the fact that you're just coming to the realization that the adults around you really don't have all the information, or in fact may not have any information, and that you really are on your own. And there's something about that moment that's really full of drama. And Ford is, you know, he's kind of returned to that territory again and again, and he mines it really beautifully.
Richard Ford's Canada, you're not the only one saying maybe it doesn't hold all the way through, but starts off lovely. Jesslyn, you've got one called The Snow Child, even further north. This is Alaska, 1920, a couple childless and kind of drifting apart, living out rough. They build a child out of snow, and what happens?
Well, this book, is really hot, even though it's called The Snow Child. I'm always hesitant to recommend it because of the season, but I think that because the book doesn't just deal with winter, I think it's a great, great summer read. The main characters in the story go to Canada in the early 1920s, and so you've got a little bit of history that you're learning along with the flow of the plot and the characters. And yes, they go into their backyard and they build a little snow girl one night. It's their one moment of levity. They just have had a brutal, brutal time, and they don't know. They might even starve through the winter. They just don't know if they're going to make it. And this is their one moment of happiness, and they build this little girl in the backyard, and in the morning when they wake up, the little girl is gone, and there are little footprints leading away from where she was, and that sort of sets the stage for the rest of the book.
And pretty soon they're glimpsing a girl sort of dashing through the woods and things. Is it sweet or violent, or where do we go here?
Well, this is a story that's based off of a Russian folktale. The author is Eowyn Ivey, who is actually an Alaskan bookseller at Fireside Books. And it was her first novel, and she's just beautifully adapted this children's fairy tale into something that adults can appreciate.
The Snow Child by Eowyn Ivey. Made from snow, and soon there's a real girl hunting with a fox at her side and off through the Alaskan near wilderness. What a great lineup. We've got all the lists, everything you've heard here, plus a sort of a top 10 and more from my guests today at our website, onpointradio.org. Check it out. And an abundance of listener recommendations there as well for your summer reading. I'm so grateful to the three of you for being with us today. Jesslyn Norcross with McLean and Aiken Booksellers way up in Petoskey, Michigan, joining us today. Jesslyn, thank you very much. Have a great summer.
Thank you so much.
Maggie Gailhouse of the Houston Chronicle, you're terrific, Maggie, and thank you so much for your recommendations today.
Thank you, Tom.
David Ulan, California, LA Times. Thanks so much, David.
My pleasure, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Look for David's Labyrinth. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.